Accession number 32713, reel 1.
It's a CV, and then they had a CBL, which is a light carrier, which is larger. CVEs, the Jeeps, were the smallest of the carrier class. It's a Casablanca class, which means hardly anything. So the pilots would go up, and everything was rush. I mean, we got to get you over there, right? Well, we all wanted to go. Well, it sounds a little strange, but it was a different time in history. It was flag waving, and let me get over there, and I'll take care of whatever. And that's really a pathetic way, but that's the way it was back then, time in history. So they would come in, and they would mess up, and there wasn't that much time to get it right before you go. Well, that's acceptable. Acceptable was very marginal. I mean, it was a marginal thing. But, I mean, if you get this thing in the air and you can fire a gun and you can come back and do somewhat of a crazy landing on a carrier, which was that type of situation that we found ourselves in. I wasn't a pilot. I was a gunner in a turret. A turret gunner on a TBM. We had TBMs, or we had TBFs. We had F4Fs, the Wildcat, and we had the F6 Hellcat. That was about it. We didn't have, we never saw Bearcats that came later, and F8s and all kinds of different aircraft. But going back to this carrier landing, it was just, if you could get a plane off the ground and you could come in, and if your landing wasn't that great, it didn't have to really be that great aboard a carrier. All you had to do is have the right path, the right attitude. And if you were flared too much or if your nose down a little bit, you're saved by the cables, the arresting cable stretch. And then if you just hip-hop around, they hit the barrier, which is a huge steel thing. You don't want to hit it. I mean, I'm talking antiquity again, guys. None of this feather stuff, hitting stuff and foam runways and stuff. If you hit that, it chews up everything, and you have to reline it, and you got to throw it over. We had a jettison ramp specifically for that purpose. If they came in and made a bad one, which it goes into the barrier, 9 times out of 10, the pilot would come out unscathed. I mean, he had a stomachache or something. That was about it. Then they would take the important documents out of the plane, all of the secret stuff. Back then, everything was plexiglass, and they had documents and map information, etc., and lat long and this and that, and we just shove it over the side. I mean, it's dispensable. You don't have time in an engagement area, or if you're going to an engagement area to repair anything, it was dispensable. You just throw it over the jettison ramp and say bye bye, and it's up. That was it. Then we went out into the war area. Of course, we had the Okinawa incidents, and we had the Guam and the Marianas with the Saipan, Rota, Tinian, the usual stuff, the Marshall Islands, et cetera, had the whole shebang out there. And Murphy's Law, anything could happen, would happen, and did. It was kind of nice to be able to be there as a charter. I mean, we were right there instead of picking up the ship in Honolulu. Well, we had already seen some action, and we weren't seasoned veterans, but we had a couple of ribbons and a couple of stars, and had 2 or 3 engagements. And when we went back for some repairs into Honolulu, we took on board some what we call green sailors, and we had to kind of be their moms, their dads. And we were glad to do that, because aboard ship, it's your home. A ship is your home. Your shipmates are your family. You guys can relate to that. Do anything in the world for them, probably more than you would for your family. I know I did. But they would do the same for you. They would come aboard, and our first engagement, of course, we had to kind of be big brother. And so, they're shaking and this, that, and the other. And we thought, well, hey, we were that way too. But then it was good that we could show them the ropes, so to speak, and everything came out fine. Steamed on aboard, and we would get attacked. Kamikaze, we had it all. We had everything but a submarine. Never got fired on by a submarine. We were in what they call Task Force 52.9, which was just a taffy, you know, the nicknames go, a taffy 3 squadron. And excuse my head, because this is kind of like an old friend of mine. I've been caught sleeping with his hat on, you know. Usually if I go into church, I do take it off, or if I see the flag or what. But my family kids me about, you know, we wouldn't recognize you on the street without your cap. But there's nothing, you know, dishonorable. Went on to, steamed on over to the Marshall Islands. We did that and went to the Three Islands and the Marianas. And that was it was our first big engagements, if they weren't all big. But we met and came in contact with the Japanese fighter planes, which, you know, nicknames again, the Tonys, the Zeeks, the Howls, etc., and then the bombers were the girls, the Bettys, the Kates, etc. Met them all, and they would come out of the sun, just like it says in the movies and the newspapers. They didn't have to, but that was their way. And antiquity still lives. Nowadays, they can't get away with that. I mean, it's miles and miles of sonar and identification systems, etc. Back then, it had to be visual. They always came in an overcast day. They knew that. They knew the weather. They would come in, and before you would know it, before general quarters would sound, before you could get to the battle stations, they would be on you, all over you, even before we could get our airplanes off the deck, which is a subject. We could take the F-4Fs off. The Wildcats could be off. I mean, they'd be back on the stern, back by the after elevator, warming up all at once, and the TBMs had to be catapulted. There was not enough space. Antiquity again. The Hellcats could take off. It was marginal, iffy, but in high seas was best because the bow would raise, and they had it pretty well timed. They had to have it timed well for the catapults, because when you pull the TBM or the TBF up on the catapult, you had to wait until a bow rise for this thing to go, and it's all steam compression. Antiquity. Nowadays, it's push a button and that, but it was a special crew there. Of course, a lot of the times that we would be catapulted from the TBM, never got airborne. It would go low, and then the ship would go hard right, and like I say, Murphy's Law, anything that happened would happen. We had one that had I believe the rudder was stuck with a bolt, and you hear that every now and then in a commercial thing or some little, you know, stuff. It cost 7 cents. It cost $65 to make, or $165. Got wedged in, and of course the airplane went up like that and came tail down. Was loaded with depth charges, and they're set. Depth charges are big barrels with explosives. It was armed with a Mark 10 aerial torpedo in the bomb bay, and we had two of the depth charges that were already dialed in for certain depth. Submarine patrol was every morning, which they called anti-submarine patrol, ASP. At dawn, we'd go around and look for periscopes, or as they call them, wakes, and go around. If there's anything there, we'd use depth charges for those, or if it was a surface craft, we happened to see those. Then, of course, the aerial torpedoes. Didn't get a lot of torpedo action except in coves, like in the islands. We'd go in and make a strike on an island after the Rangers, poor guys, after they mopped up the island, we'd go in and maybe catch a gunboat or something, but hardly a torpedo effect there. Don't waste them. So we go in on a strafing run. It was pretty effective. If it's dark, of course, you use tracers. And this was the horrible thing about flying, is you guys that were in the service, whatever, Air Force, Marines, whatever, you can see it coming. I mean, it's not nice. It's not a good thing, but you could see them spread, too. I mean, they'd come right at you, and then you ducking, which is dumb. It's a normal and average thing to do. It's just reflexes. So you can see these things coming and spraying. Well, they might get somebody over here, but you're still going, and Okay, I got through that one. But the cove things were just strafing gunboats and PT boats. They did have PT boats the same, almost as good as ours, but they were few, very few, and they were carried aboard usually a light cruiser. We didn't have a lot of island activity. In other words, the only time we landed, let's say we aboard my carrier, our pilots landed on Saipan on Aslito Airfield maybe 2 days after it was all battened down. It was all secure. We came in and I thought, wow, this is great. And it was so hokey, you know, and uncool. But at the time, it was cool to me because I thought, because when you're up and you're coming in on a Jeep carrier, I mean, a full-line carrier, a CV is bad enough, so that the Enterprise or the Saratoga, some of the big guys, it's different. But a Jeep carrier is like a shoebox. I mean, it's virtually like a shoebox coming in. And I thought, we're going to land on land? We're going to land on Earth? I mean, my gosh, look at this thing. And it was kind of, you know, kind of like having dessert after a meal, which we never had, but come and land on actual land on a field, and this was a huge airfield, Aslito, and it was tough to secure. Oh my gosh! So we had battleships, we had the Helena, which was a heavy cruiser, we had the Maryland BB battleship, and they came in and they just knocked every palm tree, every little nook and cranny out of this thing, and of course, they're like the Germans, only a little bit with the pillboxes and their concrete bunkers, et cetera. And that's where the Marines came in and the Rangers. They would come in with the satchel charges. And you guys might have been there. You may have seen it in movies. If you haven't, they come up there and they just run in there and they cover them and they go over there with those satchel charges. And, man, that's heavy stuff. That's heavy stuff. And, of course, they would come out and with their arms up and this, that, and the other. Cruised on over, next action, the significant action was, of course, Guadalcanal was in that area to get ahead of myself, Okinawa and Guam, all of those little tidbits of land masses. Went back in for another repair because we got some shells from various aircraft that would come over. Some of the bombers would come over, and the Zeros and the Zeeks of the Japanese were very fast, very fast. We didn't want to admit it, but they were. The Wildcat was taken out of service. I mean, I understood it was taken out of even frontline carriers because they were getting outmaneuvered. I mean, the Zeros were slapping them to death. I don't know whether it was the short wingspan it had. It certainly had enough engine. But we were losing a lot of them, and they would take them out. We went back to Pearl Harbor this time, and, of course, there was still remnants, but we had to go in for dry dock, so we went in and had the keel repaired, et cetera. Then we had the camouflage, which was kind of psychological, didn't it? I mean, you can see a big ship, you know, on the surface, never mind the little light blue and red blue and stuff. I mean, you can see it, but it was a psychological thing. It worked. I mean, it worked for a while, but it was a psychological thing, and it did help from a certain degree or the certain, you know, light, the time of day, sun shining or sun not shining. It was effective, and it was a government regulation, so you can't get out of that. We steamed on around the Lady Gulf area, and of course it was kind of a lot of stress. They call it psychological stuff today. It was just stress back then. We didn't know what that meant, you know. Got a job to do, we did it, and chaplain would come in. We knew that was bad because we didn't know where we were going, but that's when we would be told that we were going and what to expect. Which is kind of strange. It's like if all of us left the building, but before we left the building, you know, there's 142 mean bikers out there, and they're high on pot. That's sort of an analogy. It might be stretching it a little bit, but that's not too far off. We would kind of want to, you know, kind of like, well, what kind of weapon you got, or where does that door lead, or whichever. But that's an analogy. But we would, instead of taking it as a negative, like, oh boy, what are we going to do now? It was a time in history again where everybody bonded together. It wasn't a macho thing. It wasn't like, oh boy, I'm going to kick butt here. But it was a mutual admiration group that says, we got to do the best we can. This is we got our home. We got to protect it. Sure you do. You know, you got to go in there. And it worked. And then we had, speaking of psychological warfare, we had Tokyo Rose. Europe had Axis Sally. Okay, I drew up with the Frank Sinatra era, the big band. Well, Frank Sinatra was having Fainting in the Aisles at the Paramount and the Palace in New York. And she would come on and she would play the most recent record before the United States got that record. She was with old 70. She would have a copy of this record by Frank Sinatra and Harry James, singing with Harry James and his band at that time in 40, 41, 42, before we had it. Okay, that's some kind of spy stuff, you know, we get it. But to those that were sensitive, it probably affected more. I know I was the same, but I was a kind of a straight arrow, kind of a nerd. You know, I went by regulation. The Blue Jackets manual is probably why I'm here tonight. I'm not ashamed of it. I've changed since then. I've gotten a little more open, a little more humor, you know, a little more gray instead of black and white. And I think that was important. And I'm very proud that I did. I know other guys that didn't, and that was their way, and mine is mine. But we would listen to her, and she would say, and she mentioned our ship's name, and the number, CVE-73, USS Gambier Bay. She knew who was in the fleet, the USS St. Lo, the USS White Plains. It was the USS Fanshawe Bay. A lot of our carriers in those days were named by bays. Some of them were in the Alaska area. So we'd say, what does she know? But we enjoyed it. It was entertainment. And she would play Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra and Harry James and all of the old-time singers. And we just took it as entertainment. Otherwise, Radio Free Europe we would get. And we'd get all that stuff through there. And never mind all of the entertainment stuff we had. It was sort of a crutch. It kept us from, you know, going crazy or going whatever, you know, because getting some sleep. You got to sleep. A lot of times you slept on the flight deck, and you would look up at the radar screen. The radar goes round and round, and you're okay, and you got one eye open looking for that thing to stop. Well, it would stop. It would, and then it would go like this, and then it would go like that, and then it would stop completely. He's laughing. He knows what I'm talking about. Stop completely, and you could bet the farm. You bet the farm that the gong is going to go off. Sure enough, da 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 da, and then the man in the mouth saying, "You know, you don't know what surface craft." Well, we never knew what surface craft it was in those early years. You knew it was an airstrike. Okay, and then the CIC, Communication Information Center, would come in. CIC would come in. Well, there's so many bogeys and, you know, expect blah, blah, blah. Well, everybody go in and man and a craft. Our biggest gun, we can say gun, was on the fantail and it was 5-inch. Well, yeah, we had 40 millimeter, we had 20 millimeters along the gangway. And they were rapid fire, pretty good. On the 40s, they had a pointer and a trainer. The trainer would go the sideways and the pointer would go up and down. And it was very effective because we'd had en route to an engagement when we had time and the seas were calm, we would have some sled practice. One of the destroyer escorts would tow a sled behind the ship at whatever yardage, 250, 300 yards, whatever the gunner control officer wanted them to go. And we'd fire everything on board, you know, until the barrels got hot and we'd stop. The 5-inchers, were also deployed, used there in aircraft. We'd tow a sleeve, a target sleeve behind an aircraft, usually a TBM. Probably the only one that could, you know, stay because of the wing mass of a TBM. That's and that powerful Wright Cyclone engine kept that thing airborne. And we'd target practice with that. The 5-inch shells on the fantail, we thought we really had something there. I mean, 5-inch, that's nothing, you know, but it's effective if it hits something. It's bigger than a, you know, 22. So we had that. So it would go, and the cones were always synchronized with a wrench. If you've got like 250 yards, 500 yards, these are set to explode at a certain distance. And atmospheric pressure and all that stuff was ushered in on that. When we found out we were going to the Philippines, we thought it was to protect General MacArthur's return. Remember, I shall return. Yeah, well, he returned. So did we. We were, in effect, dispensable. We were decoys. Okay, and it's no secret. We knew it pretty soon after we got there because we didn't see the 7th Fleet. Mark Mitcher was the Admiral of our fleet. Bull Halsey and Nimitz were buku miles away. You know, maybe by choice or maybe by accident. It's a history thing. It's just like before Pearl Harbor, as I was telling some friends that... there was an admiral who knew that attack was imminent. President Roosevelt wanted another war. It's good for business, good for commerce, good for industry. Who knows? Could be. Who knows? That's water under the bridge. So we steamed on out. Sure enough, we got, almost to Lady Gulf. And one morning, I'm getting to the end of this. You guys hit me with an apple or something once. I'm kind of like on a roll. If Ron Liebman was here, he would have the hook like this, going, "Hey, get Bert over there. We want to go home. We're hungry." But anyway, getting to it. So we went on, and we knew nothing was around there, and we thought, "Hey, it's pretty clear sailing, clear seas, and everything." And our and the submarine patrol would go out and as a reconnaissance and search around. Nothing. Get back to CIC and expecting a dogfight or something, which was fun, you know. If you're not there, if you're scrubbing a deck, or if you're a yeoman, or if you're a ship's photographer or whatever, that's okay. That's fun to hear all that, you know. You hear that in the movies, you know. Hey, you know, get him on the right. All right, yeah, all that's true. So we went ahead and we had normal situations. Expecting anything. We didn't know what the politicians had in store for us because they were the ones that were saying, go here, come back here, go there. And the admirals had to listen to the politicians in Washington. Nothing's changed. So anyway, the commander-in-chief of Pacific, SINCPAC, got in touch with the fleet, and that's when Nimitz and Halsey and the big boys, the big ships, the big carriers, the battleships, the heavy cruisers, light cruisers, destroyers, all the whole nine yards away out here somewhere. And we felt bad about it because you need Big Brother around when you need some help. Like if you got a Big Brother and some bully jumps on you and you're skinny and you can't handle it, and Big Brother sees this, he comes over and wipes up the play yard with him. Believe me. We went on in and the morning of October 25th of 1944, my God, 57 years ago? Yeah, hey, 57 years ago. October 25th of 44, we'd just gotten through eating a great breakfast of beans and Brussels sprout breakfast. Beans and Brussels sprouts, and we had cucumbers that were sliced. I mean, it's breakfast, yeah, sure. So anyway, I think it made us meaner. Anyway, we got that down and almost got through with having another cup of coffee, which was, they called it mud in the Navy. I don't know what you guys call it, but we call it mud, and it was like mud. But, it's good. So we heard GQ sound, General Quarters the bell, sergeant, everybody going up the ladders, and this, that, and the other, and gulping it down, and not, you know, we figured it's another airstrike. We figured any kamikazes are coming in again. You know, our ships, we had nine in our group. We had four Jeep carriers, and we had three destroyers and two destroyer escorts. That was it. That was our little area there. We went up, and we were getting, if you excuse me.
It's not a shroud. It's actually a blanket. Okay. The Japanese used colored. The Japanese used colored dyes in their shells. The blue, pink, we had yellow at times. And they were used for gunnery ranges. In other words, okay, blue up one or whatever they used, but that's about the size of it. But it was fire control. Say up three. These were near misses. When we got through with breakfast, this was happening. Okay, this was happening. When we got through with breakfast, went to general quarters. We started looking up for high level aircraft bombers. We didn't know what it was. It's very, very misty sea, very foggy. Okay, that's good. Thank you. We came to our battle stations. The flight control officer, of course, got everybody ready for the airplanes, all the pilots. At that time, as I'm speaking of now, we had, of course, a pilot. We had an engineer, believe it or not. Was like they call him an engineer and a radio man. He did it all. He was the guy there. We had a turret gunner and a stinger. Actually, Stinger was right back here, okay, who had no room to move except no room to run, for sure. I mean, lying flat, and it was kind of like over in a loop like that. Later on, they dispensed with the radio man because the turret gunner or the man in the back was operating the radio, etc., because we were multi-talented. We thought it wasn't a talent, it was something we had to do, and we learned it. So sometime we'd go with the three-man crew, run out of airplanes. You don't have all those guys. You got more guys, you got airplanes, so then they cut down the crew, so it'd be like a three-man crew. Going back to here, everybody was on the flight deck like idiots. You know, I'm ready to get in the plane. The pilots are running. They got their chutes on. They got their chest packs, and they're slapping their butts with the seat packs. We get ready to take off. Oh, another operation. We'll be back. And then one of the airplanes that had been on another carrier that had come from Nimitz's fleet, and the 7th Fleet had kind of made a zigzag because they knew the action was over there, but they're too far away to do anything. So we got in our airplanes, and then we could see the pagoda mast, which is significant, just a silhouette. And I think you guys, Air Force guys, Marine guys, Navy guys, have the flashcards, and it's good. And I paid attention to all that. I could tell Tony from a Zeke, and of course a Betty from a B-24, a Liberator, or whatever, and that was good. And I always liked that because it came in handy later. We started getting near misses, and so we took off what we could off the deck, and the TBMs were catapulted. We only got about three or four because we didn't think we were in kind of a skirmish. But then the flight deck got a hit. And we thought, what in the world is going on? Then we visually saw the fleet because it came out of the Borneo and down through the straits and was hidden all this time. And at that time in 1943 and 1944, this happened in October 25th of 44, We didn't even know the Japanese had a fleet. We didn't even know they had a navy. We thought they had gunboats and little fishing boats and scoundrels running around and everything. They had the Yamato. They knew about the Yamato, but they